Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Oklahoma Center for the Humanities is presenting a symposium this Saturday on Native American cuisines, traditions, and contemporary contexts, which will feature chefs Ben Jacobs and Matt Chandra, the chefs of Tukabe, an innovative Native cuisine restaurant in Denver, Colorado, along with experts on the connections between cultural wellness and bodily health. There'll also be a showing of Sterling Harjo's new television pilot for Tradish, a program featuring the stories of Native chefs who are recovering traditional recipes and foods, as well as crafting and creating new ways Native foods can evolve. My guest today will also be a part of one of the panels on the symposium. Joe Johnston is a folklore historian, mystery writer, and songwriter. He's the author of the Mack Marsden's mystery series, several histories on Missouri vigilantes in the Civil War era. But his latest book is a folkloric history of Southern cooking, a combination of history along with personal recollections of the essential elements of Southern cooking. Grits to Glory, How Southern Cooking Got So Good is published by Pelican. And he'll be a guest at the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities Symposium on Native American Cuisines, which takes place Saturday at Gilcrease Museum. And by the way, the symposium is free to the public. Joe Johnston is my guest today. Joe Johnston, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I'm very happy to be here.
You're going to be participating in this Oklahoma Center for the Humanities Symposium on Native American Cuisines, and your latest book is somewhat of a departure. You're still writing about history. You've written a number of histories of desperados in the West and vigilantes and mystery series, but this new book, Grits to Glory, How Southern Cooking Got So Good, it's more of a cultural history on the origins of Southern cuisine.
That's right. I call it a folk history. It's the way people tell the history, not exactly the way historians tell it. To me, the excitement in history is finding the stories, the anecdotes that make up the big picture.
Where did you start on this book?
This book started probably when I was living on New Haven, just about a mile from here, and on the corner down at 11th Street was a hamburger joint called Harden's Hamburgers. One night I was in there with my parents eating hamburgers, of course, and there was a guy in the kitchen.
This is many years ago. Yeah, this is the 60s,
more
right?
than a few. Yeah. There was a guy in the kitchen whipping up fried chicken, and they came out and brought everybody a piece of chicken and let us all try it and so forth, and the guy in the kitchen was Colonel Harlan Sanders. So not too long after that, Johnny Harden started serving Kentucky Fried Chicken. That was when the colonel was driving around with his pressure cooker in the trunk of his car and cooking up samples. So I think it gave me a hint of the restaurant business and how that works in the South as a form of hospitality. So I think it kindled an interest in me that really came out as this book much later.
Now, you tell the story of Southern cooking, and really it's not about recipes. This is more a cultural history, homespun in a way, because you are using a lot of people you've known in your life who had their own thoughts about where Southern cooking came from. But in it, you tell the story, and really for what we know as modern Southern cooking, really comes after the Civil War, doesn't it?
That's right. Everything kind of from the days of the Pilgrims to the Civil War, everything got better. People got richer. They got more stuff. Rich people imported stuff. They imported food, including oysters and fish from around the world, all kinds of spices from around the world. Thomas Jefferson got enchanted with pasta when he was in Europe and imported a pasta-making machine. So then he popularized macaroni and cheese in the White House. So everything was getting better until the Civil War. Then after the Civil War, there were so many changes in America, but notably the South was destroyed more or less.
Devastated, yeah.
Economically, socially. I was checking some numbers recently. The population of the United States at the beginning of the Civil War was about 31 million, and there were about 4 million slaves at the time. So just imagine by 4 years later, 4 million people were renting houses, buying groceries, traveling, buying shoes, all kinds of things.
They might be traveling, but they're traveling with their feet mainly.
Well, yeah, traveling and actually earning money and spending money. So people who hadn't done that before. And meanwhile, there were a lot of white people in the South who had been on top of the world and suddenly weren't any anymore.
And not only for the plantation class that, mm-hmm. that saw huge losses,
right.
for poor white farmers.
Exactly.
And for slaves who are now becoming sharecroppers, if the richest class had very little, the poor classes had even less.
Right. And so that's where all this cuisine came from, poor people. You know, Confederate veterans came home and had no rights. There were certain jobs they couldn't hold. They couldn't hold public run for office. They couldn't speak in public, couldn't speak in church, all those kinds of things. Meanwhile, newly freed African Americans were given the vote and had a lot of the rights that Confederate veterans didn't. This period also gave tremendous rise to the power of the Southern woman. A lot of men didn't come home after the war. Men came home injured psychologically or physically, men without limbs who couldn't work the way they worked before. So a lot of responsibility for the home and the farm fell on American Southern women for the first time, and they rose to the occasion. The repositories of knowledge were not the wealthy people. The repositories of knowledge about how to eat were poor white people, former slaves, and Native Americans. And that's where so much of our Southern cuisine comes from.
Now, this Gilcrease Symposium, Center for the Humanities Symposium, is going to look at Native American cuisines. Obviously, corn is the most popular staple that we associate with Native Americans, but how did that affect Southern cooking?
Well, you know, corn is the thing. It's corn, corn, and more corn. Corn is so resilient. When other crops fail, corn usually still does well. It can grow. I've grown corn in plots as small as maybe 4 by 6 feet and been successful with it. So we see these great stands of corn, but really you can grow it in little corners anywhere. Native Americans have long preserved their food by drying it, and corn is a food that lends itself to drying and reconstituting in various ways. So corn was the staple for everybody in the South, and it originated with Native Americans. You know, thousands of years ago, corn was looked like wheat, had little bitty kernels on little bitty stalks, and it was gradually cultured to become the corn that we know today. But from South America, Central America, Mexico, Native Americans brought us potatoes, tomatoes, all kinds of spices, notably the pepper, all kinds of peppers. And these things didn't quite catch on as well. You know, they traveled up through America, but didn't quite catch on in the North because there was so much influence from Europe with dairy products, cheese, and sweets. People loved their sweets in the North. And they didn't take to the spicy foods as well. Tomatoes, of course, are very central to Southern cooking, not so much up north. So that's the way all those kinds of things came. Then Native Americans had the techniques for drying food. They fried food. The fry bread that we see at powwows and so forth now started just that way, frying balls of cornmeal in bear fat.
And so your book, Grits to Glory, sort of details this story and all the traditions involved with Southern cooking. After the Civil War, you know, food stocks had been devastated in many places. They'd been depleted because there was no one to work farms. In many cases, invasion from the North had destroyed food stocks, sometimes deliberately, mm-hmm. as a part of quelling the rebellion in the South.
Exactly.
And one of the things I found interesting is how you detail how families did make do in the first years after the war, in which really they're going back to maybe a couple generations ago to early colonists where they're living off the land more.
Yeah, exactly. You know, early colonists and living off the land reminds me of the stories of Thanksgiving, which are, you know, all that about the banquet table with the Indians is largely a myth, but history is full of little anecdotes about Indians teaching people how to eat and sharing food and that sort of thing. And it wasn't just the pumpkins, you know, it was a lot of things in the South. It was the fish. Indians taught immigrants which fish to eat, how to find them, how to fix them. And, of course, all along the coast, there was this tremendous history of preparing seafood. Interestingly, around Louisiana, where we find Creole and Cajun cooking, and we think of that as a French import, it's really only marginally French. That cooking is based around the red bean, which is a Native American crop, and rice, of course, and seafood. And then okra, of course, is an African import that the slaves brought and caught on in the South.
I always thought of it as more of an amalgam of French and the West Indies cuisine, because most of the slaves didn't come directly from Africa. They came from the West Indies. Into the southern United States.
Right. And then another Native American aspect of that is the filet, which is sassafras. And sassafras was a favorite spice of the Choctaw people. So they contributed that to the jambalaya and gumbo and all that sort of thing. So all of that is so blended together. You know, in Oklahoma, this is one of the things that I'm particularly interested in because my family and my wife's family are both involved in it. In Oklahoma, we're so conscious of the five civilized tribes and the other associated tribes who were removed. There were a lot of Native Americans who were not removed. And I'm not talking about just the old Cherokee Nation in North Carolina. There were a lot of people who escaped and hid in the hollows and hills. There were some people who married and blended, especially among the Cherokee with their fine features, were able to blend. So those people remained in the South and shared their traditions in North and South Carolina, Tennessee, the Deep South, along with former slaves. I'm diverging here, but one of the interesting things to me in the book is that people in the South favor pies, while cakes are more favored up North. Well, why do we like pies in the South? Well, we don't have much white flour in the South. For example, there's an area where my family originated in Missouri, settled in Missouri, where people didn't have any white flour until after the Civil War. Now, that's in Missouri. That's pretty far north.
That's what I was going to say. What did they use to—
Cornmeal.
Cornmeal.
Yeah.
They had cornmeal crust?
Yeah.
Interesting.
They used cornmeal for everything. They could make a pie crust. They made— have you ever heard of hoe cakes?
I have heard of hoe cakes. I'm not sure I've ever had one.
Well, a hoe cake is a little corn fritter that's baked on the blade of a hoe.
Really? Okay.
You stick a hoe in a fire, heat it up, and put a dollop of cornmeal batter on there, and you cook up a little cake. It was a farm worker thing. It was a slave thing. And so then some people even kept a hoe blade beside the fireplace or on the stove to cook hoe cakes.
Interesting.
So how do we get off on that, for heaven's sake?
I don't know, but this is what your book's about, really.
People didn't have white flour in the South. You know, something like 75% of the railroad lines in America before the Civil War were in the North. So we didn't have trains bringing in big loads of white flour. So people in the South just didn't have white flour. They used cornmeal. You can make a pie crust out of it. You can make almost anything. You can make sweets with it. People would make cornbread in variations, whether fried or baked. They would make it with nuts and fruits in it. So in the South, fruit grows very well, especially peaches. We don't think of apples as being a Southern fruit, but there's an apple called a pippin that is very adaptable, and old recipes used to call, instead of apples, it would call for a cup or whatever it is of pippins.
Interesting.
Sliced two pippins.
Yeah. And of course, there are other aspects of Southern cooking that you go into in the book Grits to Glory. My guest today is Joe Johnson. He's an author of several books, including some mysteries as well as some Western histories and histories of vigilantes. And his latest book is titled Grits to Glory, How Southern Cooking Got So Good. It's published by Pelican. And he'll be featured in an Oklahoma Center for the Humanities Symposium on Native American Cuisines, Traditions, and Contemporary Contexts, which takes place with a dinner Friday evening, which is a ticketed event. But the symposium on Saturday at Gilcrease Museum will be free. And there'll be a couple of panel discussions as well as a showing of Sterling Harjo's pilot for Tradish, show on Native foods and Native food traditions. And really, this is a lot of what your book is about, too, where the traditions came from. You go into the whole idea of how, especially many poor people in the South after the Civil War, well, always did this, but the tradition of canning and preserving, of using what was on hand, of using small game that we don't normally eat. You know, I think of the great delicacy of turtle soup, and really turtle soup came out of necessity, right?
You must have read the book.
Try.
Turtle soup, which hardly anybody eats anymore unless
except
you go
in New Orleans.
New Orleans,
and then
exactly.
That's a great delicacy, yeah.
And in New Orleans, it's generally served with a glass of wine, and yeah. Most people pour the wine into the turtle soup. Turtle soup was so popular. You know, turtle is everywhere, so poor people could always, even if they didn't have ammunition, even if they didn't have a gun or a trap, they could go out and find a turtle to eat. There are ways to build turtle traps with rocks in the water. And they can be caught by hand. They can be caught by noodling, yeah. Which in Oklahoma, noodlers do that sort of thing. So the turtle provided a lot of meat. It had different textures and different tastes as you go through the turtle. And it was very popular. It became so popular that recipes emerged for mock turtle soup. How do you make a calf head taste like a turtle? That sort of thing. So it was such a poor people's food that it didn't do well in grocery stores, and it didn't lend itself to pretty packaging like red hamburger does, that sort of thing, or a red steak. So turtle soup fell, and turtle meat in general fell out of favor, but it sustained a lot of people in the lean years after the Civil War. You know, the other meat that's important to the South is pork. And people go, well, why do people eat pig? You know, a lot of people don't eat pork at all. Out west, where cattle range free and a cowboy could see for miles across the prairie and go, oh, well, there's old Bossy over there. And he could ride over and round up old Bossy. In the South, there are hills and valleys and coves where cattle could hide for days. So cattle didn't do too well in the South. There was not enough grassland for them. But pigs can fend for themselves. If the farmer doesn't have anything to feed them, they can find something. If the farmer needs a piece of a little lot cleared to put in a garden, he can turn the pigs in there and they'll eat everything. They'll eat every root, turn everything up, and clear that land in no time so the farmer can put his garden in there. Pigs are easy to keep inside a fence. They don't try to get out like horses and cows do. And there were a lot of wild pigs in the South because the Spanish brought them to America, and they would escape and breed in the wild. So then they had to be bred backwards to domesticate them. Pork provides a lot of fat, which was very valuable. People in the South cook over open fires for a long time, longer than the other parts of the country. And there are a lot of reasons for that. The South was the last to get natural gas for a stove, the last to get electric stoves. They were the last to get stoves, for heaven's sake.
Right.
So for much longer, the people in the South cooked over a fireplace or outdoors, which is why we still grill outdoors today. It's the heart of Southern hospitality.
Heart of barbecue.
There's no
yeah.
greater compliment than to say, why don't you come over and grill out?
And of course, you know, now one of the prized traditions for a barbecue is being able to cook the whole hog.
The whole hog, exactly.
Yeah, and that was also a staple.
That was also a thing. Cook the whole hog, use every part of it. You know, they ate, I don't know that they ate pig brains. I'm not sure about that one. But the meat on a hog's head was prized. And every housewife knew how to split the head of a hog or a calf and scrape all that meat off the sides of it, hog jowls and so mm-hmm. forth. So the fat from hogs is rendered. The fat from beef is also rendered, and then it can be used. It will stand higher heats and can be used to cook more things, frying and adding to baking recipes and so forth. So pork just lends itself very well to cooking over outdoor fires and all those traditions in the South. That's why it's so darn popular in the South.
As you started learning about all the foods that make up Southern cuisine. Was there something that struck you from history that was like, you know, a particular usage of a food product that just took you by surprise?
There were a lot of things that took me by surprise. The thing that was most outside my experience is under the heading of using the whole hog. You know, in the Native American tradition, an animal gives itself to a hunter. And so it's very, very important to be appreciative of all those things, of the gifts of nature. And part of the way that you show that is by eating and using the whole animal, something that we don't necessarily do today. We waste so much food. If you really think about that, if you're butchering a hog, you're going to give the ears to the dogs, and they'll eat those. You're going to scrape all the meat off the head. And they also ate the organs. And organ meat actually has a name.
Sweetbreads.
Sweetbreads, exactly. And it generally tastes terrible and smells terrible when it's cooking. But there have been a lot of recipes. Anybody who is from my generation, if your mother made giblet gravy, it included the heart and the gizzard and those kinds of things. So we've eaten those. And I think that that's probably the most difficult thing for us to understand or to envision is being that hungry and that
frugal
to take care of those things, preserve those things, cook those things, and eat all those parts of the animal because for a number of reasons.
And there's also a section on the cast iron skillet, which is really interesting because, you know, cast iron skillets are now making a big comeback.
Yeah.
You know, I remember I'm of an age where my mother, you know, used her cast iron skillet pretty regularly. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting that that has gone completely out of style and now it's coming back.
Now it's coming back. Well, people appreciate the value of things like vinyl records, you know.
It's true. They're also coming back.
I'm using, my wife and I are using cast iron cookware that belonged to our grandmothers. We have one cast iron skillet that we found in a barn, and we have no idea how old it might be or who it belonged to. But if a cast iron skillet like this one is rusted, you can sand all the rust off of it.
Just reseason
it again and start over.
Yeah. But this was a big part of how you cooked everything from the very beginning of the meal all the way to the dessert.
Yeah, you know, cast iron cookware is, of course, the original nonstick. No chemicals like in Teflon and so forth. And when you had everything started with grease, you know, you take a piece of pork fat, rub it around the inside of the skillet, and then you can cook eggs or whatever you want to put in there, and it's not going to stick. So the idea of seasoning cast iron comes naturally to somebody who cooks that way. And I'd like to say, let me put in a word about fat. You know, we're so conscious of fat in our diet these days and so forth. The Southern diet, which has been so rich in fat and fried foods, was part of the most diverse diet in America because Southerners grow gardens. Think about this. What's the growing season in Ohio? What's the growing season in Alabama? People in the South can grow vegetables maybe 9 months of the year. And then there are going to be some things like greens and so forth that keep coming up during the winter and that sort of thing. So people ate a very diverse diet, rich in garden produce, wild plants, mushrooms, nuts. You know, the Native Americans ate peanuts. They dipped them in honey. And today we have Cracker Jacks, which is pretty much the same thing. With this diverse diet, yeah, sure, you can cook your eggs and bacon together, you know, that's fine. You can eat some bacon and you can eat some pork fat and you'll be just fine, especially when you go out and work as hard as people have in the South traditionally.
My guest today is Joe Johnson. He's author of Grits to Glory, How Southern Cooking Got So Good. He'll be one of the guests for the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities Symposium on Native American Cuisines, Traditions in a Contemporary Context, which takes place Friday evening and Saturday at Gilcrease Museum. And there'll be a couple of meals. There's a evening meal Friday that you would want to register in advance for, but the symposium itself is free. And there'll be several panel discussions at the museum, of which Joe will be participating in one. And
Let me mention also that Gilcrease is open to the public Saturday, free admission.
Yeah.
People can come in, and they have a special little tours, I understand, of things in the museum related to food.
Okay. So that's also going as a part of the symposium. And so you're going to be talking on a panel about what exactly?
Well, I'll be talking about these sorts of things, Native American traditions and how they have entered modern America. And that's really the gist of this panel. The others on the panel are real experts. I'm the folk historian. The others are real experts and chefs who actually work with modernizing Native American food traditions.
All right. That takes place this Saturday. And before we let you go, you know, Joe, you had a hand in one of the great cultural traditions in America, in postmodern America. You were part of the team that helped develop the Happy Meal.
That's right. McDonald's Happy Meal. This was in an era when, hard to imagine, but kids didn't want to go to McDonald's. They didn't like the hamburgers.
Why did they not like the hamburgers?
Well, they were little and dry.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, it was
prefab.
Yeah, prefab hamburgers. Exactly. So we wondered how we could get, and actually at the best customers for McDonald's are young people who have young kids. So we said, well, how can we help these people bring their kids to McDonald's? We did a lot of research, and we basically did the same thing that ended up happening with the Happy Meal, printing on the packaging. You know, we printed pictures and puzzles and games, and the kids really responded to that. But we found out that it really didn't make a difference until we put a toy in the Happy Meal. So we submitted the concept to McDonald's, and they massaged it and tested it and blah, blah, blah. And it took them a few years, but they finally rolled it out nationwide, and it became, let me add this also, much, much later, I was called to testify by the Center for Science in the Public Interest, testify against McDonald's, saying that, yes, you know, the Happy Meal works because of the toy. And that was in a lawsuit that charged McDonald's with making America's children overweight. So at any rate, I sort of have got my karma in that way.
All right. Well, the name of the book is Grits to Glory. You can see Joe as a part of the symposium sponsored by the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities. Joe, thanks very much for joining
us. Thank you, Rich.
Joe Johnston speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Grits to Glory, How Southern Cookin' Got So Good. It's published by Pelican. He'll be one of several guests presented by the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities. They present a symposium on Native American cuisines, traditions, and contemporary contexts. There'll be a ticketed dinner Friday evening, and then Saturday, a day-long symposium at Gilcrease Museum, which is free to the public. You can learn more at humanities.utulsa.edu. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.